You are listening to The Wizards of Oz, hosted by Isaac Egan, Rangor, and Rob CJ.
Good evening and welcome everybody to Wizards of Oz. This is December 2014. I'm your host, Samuel James Brent, SJB. With me tonight is Isaac Egan.
How's it going?
And Rangel.
That's me. Hey.
Well done. How are you both?
Good.
Not too bad.
Fantastic.
Not too bad.
Yeah, good. Also joining us tonight is Adam Buster Douglas.
Adam? Yo. How's it going?
And 2008 National Champion and Rookie of the Year, Aaron Nicastri. Aaron.
What's up, guys?
Now, welcome both of you to the show. Thank you so much for coming on. Now, we've asked both of you to come on the show tonight because you recently competed in GP New Jersey, which ended up being, I'm going to say, the biggest Eternal tournament ever. Is that fair to say?
I think so.
Yeah, I think we can lock that in.
Right, so about 4,000-man tournament. I think the biggest before that would have been GP Vegas. I don't think either of you were there, right?
No.
Nope.
I wanted to be there.
It was the third biggest tournament, the third biggest GP ever. So it's in an eternal format, so there's no way any event's actually been bigger than it.
Yeah, of course.
That's true.
Sure.
Do you guys like hunt this out? Because going to the States for a GP, that's like pretty big game. What inspired you guys to actually go over?
Dylan, mostly for me. He went GP, Legacy, Jersey. And the answer was pretty much yes.
I kind of wanted to see how SGC were running their events. So I wanted to go over and check out an actual SGC event and then head on over to the GP and just see what happens in that big kind of environment, because it's a very different environment to a Pro Tour or what we actually get for a GP in Australia comparatively.
Yeah, sweet. What did you think of the comparison?
It's a different level of professionalism and other things. Like, they just have a lot more people, and so a lot more things going on. Like, I was really interested in their coverage and their streaming and how they were going about the setup, as well as how you manage 4,000 people.
Have you watched back the coverage at all? I personally thought it was the best coverage of any Magic event I've ever seen.
Wow.
Watched back some bits and pieces, but it's a team that's all together that's going event to event to event to event.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're getting to do this every week. Nobody else in the world does this every week, and it's why SGC does this better than Wizards can.
But, I mean, Wizards basically has the same team together. I just don't feel like the Wizards team click quite the same way that the Star City team did. Do you know what I mean?
They're not as much current ex-pros or, you know, like the team of guys they have is, I'm going to say, not as good, basically.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. No, I really think that's a big
like,
part.
In skill-wise and, you know, on multiple fronts, like, these are the guys delivering the best content in the world and sourcing the best people to deliver that content. So they're right up with the know, as opposed to, you know, it's not really spreading to the lowest common denominator, but it's, yeah, you're getting a higher level of coverage for, I think.
Also, it's pretty important as far as their business model is concerned. I mean, Wizards' job is to print cards. Like, that's their job, to make Magic the Gathering cards and print them. And then all the other stuff is kind of secondary.
Well, they're also trying to sell to the newer market more. Like, I see that through the people that they employ and the way that they present their...
Yeah, they've got a different target market. They want newer players to be able to understand the coverage they're doing.
Concepts and that kind of thing. And it's something that SGC even pointed out, like, I think on the said talks maybe a week ago or something, like, they were pointing out that that's one of the areas that they kind of struggle with, is getting to the new players.
What's it like just being at a 4,000-man tournament? Like, it's obviously significantly larger than anything we've ever seen here. So, like, what level of magnitude is it? Like, is it just insane?
Epic. Epic. Yeah. It was ridiculous.
It just seemed like one walks across the room, that's it. Like,
For you, I was in the VIP section. I could just, you know, walk into my VIP little room and get my pairings and walk outside, and I was there.
They were pairing to your phone, so, like, you could just get a tweet and walk over to your table, which is kind of good.
Yeah, that's sweet.
So
it does make a difference.
All the little things like that that make the event way smoother.
Yeah, I think they've been trying stuff like that in Australian GPs recently, but they've still got a long way to go before they can reach those kind of
I think that there was some kind of legality or something. It's surprising that you tell me that you got online pairings, because we definitely... I know that we've been told that we can't have online pairings.
We had them in Brisbane last year.
Yeah, so there was like a brief stint of online pairings, and then it came from up on high that apparently we're not allowed to do it.
It's interesting.
Something a weird Australian law or something. There's no... If somebody else is doing it in the world under like Wizards events, then we can do it.
Yeah, that was what we were thinking. Precedence. So, yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a bit of misinformation there, exactly what's going on. But if you see like an Australian GP without online pairings, it's because Wizards have told them they're not meant to have online pairings. Right. The organisers of, I know Lindsay wants online pairings. It makes things a lot easier. So if he doesn't have it, it's not due to laziness. It's because he's been told he's not allowed to.
So did you both play the same deck on the day?
Nope.
So why don't we start with you, Buster. Tell us about the deck that you play.
I played Mono Blue Omnitel, which is essentially show and tell. I use that for great benefit to put in an Omniscience, and then cast, which lets me cast all my spells for free, and then I cast Enter the Infinite, which lets me draw my deck, and then I cast Cunning Wish, which lets me get Research and Development, which I cast the Research side to put four cards from my sideboard, or up to, into shuffled in my deck, and then, which gets a Laboratory Maniac, of which I then cast a Dig Through Time to get those last two cards, and then cast Laboratory Maniac, and then a Ponder or a Brainstorm or something else to that effect. It's a very, very straightforward deck, and it was...
Yeah, awesome. Sounds straightforward.
It was awesome.
How early does it go off?
You can go off on turn two, which I did to somebody in the last round of in the last game of day one. He was a little bit upset over it, considering he could have thought seized me turn one, because he didn't expect the Ancient Tomb that I had in my hand. Yeah, it's mono blue. I was trying to come up with a deck to play for this, because it's such a large event. I've never played an event that was expecting to be this large. And I was talking with friends, and we're going, oh, it's going to be an extremely long day. You don't want to pick anything that's going to be grindy. You just want to pick something that's straightforward, kills your opponent, and you don't have to think about it. And I didn't have any sneak attacks, so I thought, well, next best thing, it's mono blue. Don't need to worry about dual lands or wasteland.
Yeah.
So hang on a second. You're saying that part of your deck choice when you spent like over $1,000 on flights was based on you not having sneak attacks?
Well, yeah. Well, I could buy them, but I just...
To be fair, he had every other card in
foil. I could, to be fair, my entire deck was foil except for Laboratory Maniac, a polymorphous...
$4 foil.
Yeah, $4 foil, a polymorphous jest for my sideboard.
I don't know what that does.
It's... I couldn't believe it when I found it. It's 2 blue, 1, instant. Target players' creatures become 1/1 frogs with no abilities until end of turn.
Oh, shot from M15, yeah.
Yeah, the reason why is because it shuts off all the hate bears in death and taxes and, like, melee mages or anything. It just shuts them all down in one hit, and I can kill them in that turn.
Cool.
Yeah, it was pretty sweet. And also didn't have the foil City of Traders, which supposedly I found out you could get at the event or somewhere for $1,200 each, and I didn't want to spend that much. But every other deck I've got, I could build. Yeah, I could build almost any deck in the format. But I just decided this one was probably the easiest way. Well, yeah, well, my stick and show. And possibly, like, lands, depending on how many
tabernacles it plays. The Australian market has, decided that Sneak and Show is the best card ever, and now you can't ever find it or buy it based upon a team.
Oh, I could buy it if I wanted it. I just didn't want to play. I've never played it before, so I've never thought about playing it. I could have played my junk list that I've been playing for like the past year, but I got convinced.
You mean Abzan? Is that?
Yeah, sorry. Abzan. I just call it junk combo, which is recurring nightmare combo. But the addition of Containment Priest kind of shut that deck down.
Junk for a reason.
Yeah, it's definitely called junk now for a reason.
Containment Priest is like the reason why you don't go show and tell Emrakul anymore?
That's part of it. You still just do it.
Like, nobody plays Containment Priest main, and you just like run the gambit.
And not a lot of people are playing it sideboard.
How many do people have it? Like, two in their sideboard? Like,
Yeah, but I saw a few other Omnitrol players that are playing the Emrakul version, because you can play the Emrakul Release the Ants version, which you get Cunning Wish from sideboard again to get the, Release the Ants, but I just went, screw it.
What's Release the Ants? Sorry.
It's one red, one, yes, instant. Deal one damage to a creature or player, and then Clash. If you win the Clash, it gets returned to your hand. So generally speaking, you do Enter the Infinite, put Emrakul, put Emrakul on top of your deck, and then, exactly. The ants are going to eat you alive. I kind of just went, by playing the Lab Maniac route, I'm not hit by any kind of creature removal. If they're playing Sneak and Show, their Emrakul will shut down my Clash. This one, I'm quite literally just goldfishing almost. And I played it for 3 weeks leading up to the event. Worked out that Red-Blue Devil was the worst matchup ever. Because they play many counterspells and dazes and pyroblasts.
Okay, no one would have been playing Red-Blue Delver, right?
Oh, no, of course not. It was not a deck to choose.
No one's smart.
No, just everyone was using it. And I decided a couple of days beforehand, I'm thinking about, do I change decks? And I was watching Aaron and Dylan play their deck. I'm like, oh, this could be pretty good. I can build another copy of that. But then I just started stuff it. I'll play this deck. I've been playing it for as long as I have, for 3 weeks or so. I knew it. It's fairly straightforward, and did infinitely better than I expected I would.
Yeah, so on the first day you went 8-1, is that right?
Yes.
That's insane.
Yeah, amazing. I expected to be knocked out any time after round 5. because the first round was a no-show, so I'm like, yeah, sweet, a bye. I came here all this way to play Magic. I came here to play Magic, and I get a bye.
I lost turn 1. Game one, just by comparison. All
right,
your comparison is slightly better.
Yeah, slightly differently.
So when did you pick up your first loss?
Round 6, which was against Blue Red Delver.
Okay,
yeah,
fair enough.
Game 1, he played a lot of Swift Spears and just killed me, and game 2 was pretty much the same. Like, can't do much about that.
Cash, you had a feature match early on, didn't you? What were you playing?
Let's start with that. Feature match. I was playing Esper Deathblade.
And that's something that you and Dylan have been putting together for a while, right? I've been reading Dylan's posts for ages on that deck.
Yeah, I've been playing the deck for a while. We've been chatting about a lot of cards. I'd also been playing Blue-Red Delver, and we were in the same chat as Brad, Jerry, Todd, Tom, and Brian leading up to the event. So we had all their decks. We had all their information. They had all our information.
Oh, great.
We just seemed to win more with this deck. They ended up playing like a USA control deck, and I just wasn't happy with the few choices that they were making with the deck, and didn't feel like they had enough time to test it and really solve all of its problems before the day. So I went with the deck that seemed more complete.
And in what way do you think that the Esper list was a better version?
Just to clarify, Esper Stoneblade is basically Stoneforge Mystic with a Batterskull and a Jidde, and then some like Brainstorms and Counterspells.
Deathblade Shaman.
Deathblade
Shaman is what makes it the deck. Deathblade.
Okay. Deathblade.
Yeah.
So you're playing a bunch of the most powerful cards in the format. You're playing Brainstorm, you're playing Stoneforge Mystic, you're playing Deathrite Shaman, and then the rest of the cards don't matter that much. You know, Basic
Treasure
Cruise,
Play
Treasure Cruise? Swords.
Yeah,
you know.
I think he played 3 Treasure Cruise.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sweet.
And
you're just playing a whole bunch of good cards, really, and just, trying to grind opponents out of games.
Cool. What happened in that feature match? I haven't actually watched it.
I lost turn 1 of game 1, where I was on the play, and I played a Deathrite Shaman, and then he killed me.
How did he do that?
He was playing Oops, so it's no land deck, and it goes off something like 70% of the time with no disruption. And if you don't know you're playing against it, you're just going to lose. The big problem with the deck is it usually loses to like 1 Force of Will or 2 significant pieces of disruption. And in a format that's pretty powerful, it loses a lot, and especially where blue's the most predominant color, losing to Force of Will isn't really a very viable option for a lot of rounds of Magic.
No. But it is a cheap deck.
It is a cheap deck.
It's a cheap deck. So, which also explains
deck,
why I was there.
Cheap kills, and, it's good when it does its thing.
You have to think about how to kill you.
You had actually kept a really good opener as well. I was actually really excited about that match until the bad stuff happened.
Yeah, I wanted to play against Blue Red Delver or something. I actually have a grindy game where I just like attrition them out.
Yeah.
We were playing an even more grindy version of the deck because we were playing Lingering Souls, and Lingering Souls is a lot of bodies.
Yeah.
And, you know, pretty good at fighting young pyromancers and some other stuff that the format was kind of doing.
Pretty shit against Oopsal spells.
Oh, yeah, but so is True Name Nemesis. So is yeah. Any cost and three mana. So, like, oh, I don't know what the difference is apart from one you can't pitch to a force.
Yeah, you got really unlucky with that matchup. How did you finish up on the whole day?
I ended up winning that matchup. So.
Oh, no, I beg your pardon. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. I'm sorry.
I'm not going to say that I got that unlucky, you know.
No.
In Legacy, you have to sacrifice some matchups. Even if you have a deck that's pretty good against the field, which deck like Esper Deathblade is pretty good against the field, there's still some matchups that are unwinnable.
Rango, you run Legacy. Are you sober enough to talk, or are you like unconscious?
Yeah, I do run Legacy on a Monday night, and Buster's one of my regulars.
I haven't played much Legacy, and I'm sure that a lot of our listeners haven't played much Legacy. If you're getting into the format, well, you know, I know that there's some leagues down in Melbourne that allow proxies. What do you reckon is the best beginner deck to jump into the format with?
The good thing is there's now, like, I definitely know Lab at Melbourne allow proxies for their Legacy night, not their league, and we allow proxies as well. So, like, if you're in Queensland or Perth or Adelaide, you might need to talk to your stores to get that sort of thing, but otherwise you can just proxy whatever you'd like to.
Yeah, but, like, what's a good deck to start with?
I've had a guy come in and he started with mono red, and then he found out he could have proxies, and the next week he'd like proxied up. He won the other night. What's his name? Now he's bought most of his deck except for his dual lands.
Oh, so, his name? Felipe.
Yeah, and he's playing so, like
four-color. Just play one of the best cheapest decks in the format. If you can proxy like the sac land, if you can proxy the land base, then the rest of the deck's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
It's good to start with a deck that's really good in the format, and then you know you've got a good fighting chance in almost any matchup, and you know go from there, expand out into other decks and other ideas.
So Blue Red Delver.
Yeah, Blue Red Delver's pretty good. Start with the deck people know is the best, and that deck's really smooth. It's really nice.
I read some articles on Star City. I think Drew Levin actually has written a few articles about some of the best starting decks in the format, like when you're starting out, and how to actually progress from a base of, you know, buying a couple of dual lands and some other cards, and then going into progressively more expensive decks. They were very interesting to read, and I think Delver was one of them. Storm was another, I think, because you only need, like, you know, three or four dual lands. And, yeah, it was just, from there you can progress by picking up a couple extra ones and going into various kind of lines to actually get...
Playing Magic Online Cube,
yeah,
because you start to interact with some of the cards. You start to interact with the text, with the old cards, with the different ideas of different powerful things, because it's a format of powerful cards. So if you start playing in formats with powerful cards, you get a pretty good grasp of what's going on.
I mean, Blue Red Delver, I play Blue Red Delver and I love it, but I'm like entry level into Legacy. Brain, there's a really steep learning curve on Brainstorm. So I mean, if I was entering Legacy, I would want to start with a deck that doesn't have Brainstorm until I could like work out how
drawing cards is gas though. So if you enjoy drawing cards, surely Brainstorm is where it's at.
Yeah, but then you play your sac land on turn one and you crack it at the end of your opponent's turn, get a land and Brainstorm, and then you just like lock yourself for a couple of turns. Like,
yeah. But you also get to draw three cards.
That's a learning curve itself, you know, because usually an opponent at some point is going to explain what you've done, explain why that's bad, or you're going to be perceptive enough to start getting that idea.
Yeah, but correct. But I mean, we watched this guy who won the other night grow from mono red up into learning what to do and then building his own four color Delver deck and beating everyone with it because he had like more
saying,
answers
like,
than everyone could
play
do.
Maverick?
Yeah, well, I would probably play Death and Taxes is a better starting point than Delver because it sometimes just loses, but it doesn't. It has ways to leverage advantage as well as letting you learn things. Like the best thing you're going to learn with Death and Taxes is when to put things in off an Aether Vial.
Yeah,
well, Death and Taxes.
Explain Death and Taxes a little bit, Isaac.
Yeah. Does that have land tax in it? Is that
No. It's a mono white control.
It's a mono white. Yeah. So it's essentially came
Hate
about. Yeah, Hate Bears in mono white. Eventually, it came about. I think when Mangara of Corindor was printed. I think. With Aether Vial and like Flicker Wisp, but around about the same time, Back in, like, was it 2007 or something?
So you tap to exile a permanent, and then
And then you've got, Hughes Crackers. The name came about as, like, the only thing certain in life are death and taxes, because essentially this deck was one of the best sayings I've ever heard with it is, it's as if Solidarity, which is a mono-blue combo deck that uses the stack to its advantage ridiculously well, and the stack had a mono-white child. Because this deck is a mono-white creature deck that uses the stack and abuses it. Over time, it's evolved less about Mangara
It's a deck which has lots of soft locks, and knowing when and how to place them is, like, really critical, and you're also playing a less powerful deck than almost everybody else in the format.
Yeah.
I mean, which is a hard spot to be when you're learning. Well, Death and Taxes was my intro deck to Legacy. Now, I'd played a lot of other Magic and had good success, right? So I wasn't like a beginner in total. But a beginner's not going to want to play Magic in Legacy anyway. But Buster handed me that, and then I like was top fouring all the events and splitting with Buster because there's no point bashing out the guy that gave you the deck. Like, it would play itself to a point, and then if I could leverage a couple of extra things myself, it would win really well. But you basically, like, sometimes you just slam Thalia on turn two and your opponent says, well, I'm on Storm, so game over. Like,
nothing I can
move
do.
On. Yeah. Sometimes your hate fans
like
do nothing.
Like, whoops, and you can't win because you don't have a force of will.
Yeah, you know? Well, sure.
Like, there's
sure.
decks in the format that you just absolutely lose to with the deck because it doesn't do anything powerful and it has to actually grind out all its wins, which is kind of good. Long games of Magic are better for a player that's learning.
Yeah, the other thing is, though, you can just hope that the guy who's playing Oops plays against Force Round 1. Like, it's the same conundrum of Scissors, Paper, Rock. Like, that deck's so minor that you still get to learn Legacy by Death and Taxes.
There were also a lot of D&T players, actually, at the GP. I saw probably about 5 or 6, and I've played at least one of them as well. And it is
Craig
a very
Resco and the guy who won
at least 5 or 6 and 4,000 people.
Well, yeah, I mean, I saw directly off like 2 or 3 tables. But like,
I get what you mean. There were
a few around, and it's also a relatively cheap deck as well, because really the only expensive cards in it are the Ports and the Caracases.
And Wasteland.
Sorry.
Very good people on the deck, like you had Mark Koenig, who won the SGC event the next week, and you had Craig Wesco, and you had like a bunch of known players on the deck. Like, it's a good deck, but no matter what,
because he's just going to play mono white, right?
Yeah, but Wesco's won a GP Legacy event with it before as well. So,
and Mark Koenig's probably the best player of the deck. He's like the guy who's smashing Moto Cubes every day and streaming. Like, he's at least the best player in Europe of Death and Taxes, if not the best player in the world.
I mean, it definitely gives you lines of play to think about rather than just slamming things on turn two. Yeah. But it does
it also just
get there.
Get aggro. Yeah, it just gets aggro sometimes. It just kills your opponent. Like, it plays equipment. It usually plays, I think, Jits or maybe a sword, and a Batterskull. Some of them still play Mirror Crusader. Some of them play Sarah Avengers, just beat down with Flying Dorks. And I think Brumaz is even seen play now.
That's right.
I think something like 70 or 80% of Legacy plays Brainstorm. Like, it's some ridiculous count like that. It seems like you want to be one of the guys playing Brainstorm and Force. If you start,
you want to play the guy and then work your way
to the outskirts.
Or you want to be the guy who is tapping his Aether Vial to put in
for
the...
For two.
Yeah.
Screw a Labyrinth. Screw a Labyrinth.
Put in his spirit. So I want multiple events catching people with Spirit of the Labyrinth. Like,
it is beautiful.
If 80% of the people are playing Brainstorm and you're sitting there with two counters on it, you can't reasonably cast Brainstorm into that.
We played Notion Thief main. Just saying. We played one Notion Thief and one Dark Blast main. That was our spice.
Yeah, but no one plays Dark Blast except, you know, your deck.
Except people who work out that it's really good in the format at that time, that it's really good against Death and Taxes. It's really good against Red Delver, which are two, like, pretty major decks for that tournament.
I mean, there was a modern GP the same week that you guys played, and Dark Blast were playing that.
Wow.
At the same time. Because, like, it's just a concession to Delver being really good at the moment.
And it kills Pest and Mind and some other stuff. Like, it has uses in...
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things it can kill.
And stuff, like, it's kind of good.
Cool. What else have we got on the list to talk about, SJB?
I thought that maybe we'd talk about Day 2, Buster, since you made it there. Tell us about Day 2.
Day 2 is where it kind of started to fall apart. So day two, I'm 8-1, I'm pretty ecstatic, had a long day the previous day, and get in, and my first round is against Dredge. Now, Dredge, we thought about putting various sideboard cards, playing more than one copy of something that's against Dredge. We had all pretty much worked out that, we'll just concede to Dredge, because we can't beat it. We're not going to dedicate, five to seven sideboard slots to it. We're not even going to dedicate one, because even one is almost useless to against it.
So it's kind of like, if you can't beat the matchup, then dedicate some slots to it, make it really winnable, and just some of the matchups you just have to go, well, I can't beat them unless I get lucky.
Can't beat it against Dredge. Three turns in, my opponent casts his first Cabal Therapy. So I'm like, well, I don't want him to know what I'm playing, and he's not doing anything. I'll just force a will this. Four turns after that, my opponent eventually kills me, because my deck has decided to draw three Omnisciences, two Enter the Infinites, a Flusterstorm, and maybe a Force, or maybe, it was made up of all counter spells and two parts of the three-part combo. So I'm like, okay, this is kind of annoying. I would have liked to have actually interacted here, even though I should lose. If I'd have drawn anything, I could have won.
So you're losing unless he gets exceptionally unlucky. He gets exceptionally unlucky, but then you got more unlucky.
Exactly. And then the same thing happened in game two. Except this time I draw infinite ponders, preordains, and brainstorms, and still hit nothing.
So I'm X2 after that.
So I'm like, okay, now here it is. It's finally ended. And then I get paired against elves, and I kill him games 1 and 3 the turn before he's going to kill me.
I'm still alive for top 8.
So I'm like, I'm still going strong.
It's over.
Well, I'm going to lose. It's going to be over.
It's better than top 8, though, because doesn't X3 get an invite now or something?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I think it was an invite for that. Then it was, I think, the next round was against blue-black Tezzeret. And this is where I did one of the best things I love doing. I did the combo. My opponent's got a Chalice of the Void on 1. So all my Preordain, Ponder, and Brainstorm effects are just counted. So I can't actually win the game until the turn after, due to Laboratory Maniac, because I can't draw any cards. So to draw my deck. So what I ended up doing was I cast Cunning Wish, and then got Trick Bind. And then I cast a Brainstorm, and then I Trick Binded the Chalice of the Void trigger. And that was awesome. The expression on my opponent's face was awesome. So Trick Bind says counter activated or triggered ability. Can't be activated for the rest of the turn. So he triggered his Chalice of the Void trigger on my Brainstorm to counter it, and then I countered that, and I won the game. It's one of the few times that you actually have Trick Bind in the board, but it is awesome when you do it. After that, finally hit another Delver. He killed me. then I hit DNT, and I won game one very handily. Game two, I did something extremely stupid that won me the game. I know. It's like, so you lost the game because you were stupid. No, I lost the game because I did something. So I'd gone off partially. My opponent had an Aether Sworn Canonist, which only lets me play one spell a turn. So I've got my Omniscience in play, had to pass the turn, and then end of turn, I found my Chain of Vapor that I boarded in instead of my Rushing River. Now, Chain of Vapor says I can rebounce a permanent, but the controller of that permanent can then sacrifice the land to copy it. And all I've got is an Omniscience in play, and he's got lands and Aether Sworn Canonist. Now, if my opponent decides to actually sacrifice a land, he can bounce my Omniscience, and I can't win. Now, as soon as I cast it, I realized what I'd done. I made it so my opponent could kill me still. And I went, okay, don't do anything. Don't show any expression. Just say, is that okay? And my opponent's like, sure, okay. I'm like, don't say anything. Shut up. Put the card in my graveyard and proceed to kill my opponent. game three, he won handily because he had a Spirit of the Labyrinth, which means I can't draw any cards, Aether Sworn Canonist, which means I can't cast multiple spells a turn, and Athalia, which means all my spells cost one more. which is why... and I was actually pretty close to casting the Polymorphous Jest. I was one blow off casting that and then killing my opponent before he killed me. So it was pretty close. After the match, I told my opponent, you do know what Chain of Vapor does, right? And he's like, no. Just bounces a spell, right? And I'm like, you may want to read this card, and you know, for next time, just may want to read
such
it.
Such a nice guy, Buster.
Oh, well, you know, he may see it again, he may not, you know, I don't mind, you know, whatever, it's I was just
that's
awesome.
The kind of thing that I tend to do after I've beaten someone, not after I've lost.
Oh, you
lost, you're dirty and you walk away dirty, right?
No, part of
what Pen of Aether does.
Yeah, part of the reason why is because I was having a fantastic time. I didn't care that I lost, I was just, the entire event was fantastic. I was just happy to be there.
That's an awesome place to be, was Magic.
Yeah, it's a great place to be. Then I got paired against Elves and beat him because I managed to...
faster than Elves when I watched
faster
game.
Than Elves, however, if they have Vuritzar is actually kind of hard to deal with if you're not on 13 life with a Cunning Wish or 19 life with a Enter the Infinite in hand. You kind of need a Cunning Wish in your hand and be on 13 life to be able to take 12 damage to kill them, or you need to be on 19 life to then cast the Enter the Infinite and then the Cunning Wish and then kill them. And then the spell that you go get to bounce the Vuritzar and then kill them. So it's a little bit of a jump through lots of hoops and hope like hell they don't have Vuritzar in their hand. He didn't have it in game one.
Ah, because you cast Show and Tell and you both put a permanent into play.
Yeah, he put... Yeah.
Vuritzar
in and then... Sorry, yeah. So that's what he did. I think game two, I think Crater Hoofed me. And game three, I managed to... I think he had it, but I got the... at a Polymorph's Jest, I think, in my hand and I used that. So that shut that down. That was awesome. Turned it into a blue frog with no abilities and then proceeded to kill him. It was awesome.
So D&T can do the same thing to you off the show and tell as well, Isaac.
Yes,
so
yes.
You go show and tell and they put in Spirit Edison Labyrinth. Canonist.
Yeah.
Or Spirit and Labyrinth. Yeah.
Or Thalia.
Thalia, if they still have mana, they might be able to get to their sideboard to deal with.
Yeah, true.
But Edithsworn Canonist locks them out for three turns, at least two turns, because then they have to go in their sideboard next turn, and then the turn after they can deal with Canonist.
Yeah.
As long as D&T has done nothing else.
Yeah. And in that interim, they're beating you down, so it's a little bit hard.
If the wing card Demripil, you can also just put Caracas in and just bounce it.
If you have Emrakul, yeah, they can bounce it, which is one reason why you've got to be careful if you're playing Show and Tell at the Emrakul version and you're expecting to just win with Emrakul. They can put in Crackers and then just bounce it and you're dead. Then my last round, so I was playing against AJ Satcher, actually, a pro that I hadn't, one of the only pro I think of the day that I played against. He was playing Blue Red Delver, fairly demolished him game one, and then game two went, I think, for so long, I went, like, I think 30 minutes or so, and the entire time I'm just trying to resolve things, and I force a world his early dork, but eventually got there, and game three he got me pretty quickly. But it was awesome. I loved it. The entire day.
Props from him for, like, a good tight match.
Yeah, because he actually said, it was a good match, which I was quite happy to hear from a pro. The entire weekend was great.
You guys went up to New York, and you saw some shows and shit while you were there?
Yeah, so on the Wednesday after we got there, I got in on the 10th, and the Wednesday before the event, I think all of us went there along with Mackenzie Strathford, a judge, went to New York. Me and Mackenzie had booked a show to see Matilda the musical, because, like, why not? We're in New York and Broadway and stuff. Afterwards, we booked a show to see Aladdin with the other two guys. Matilda was actually...
with R Us and Legoland and Nintendo World and all that kind of shit while they... went and watched Matilda, by the way.
So that was the Wednesday. Then I think walked around a bit, saw a bit of New York. Went and saw Aladdin. Wanted to slap Mackenzie because he had said he'd never seen the actual cartoon, like the actual movie.
Well, anything that actually is like a real thing that his generation should have seen.
Sounds like a pretty sweet trip.
Yeah. It was awesome.
And then you came home and had to go back to real life.
We spent we got to spend a night drinking with all the kids after the event as well.
Oh, that's good.
We all went to a bar on the Sunday night with like Brad, Jerry, Patrick Sullivan, I don't know, all the cool guys, and we started having fireball shots, which are cinnamon whiskey. If anybody wants to know, it's the best stuff ever.
Surprisingly tasty.
And yeah. We were having drinks and chatting about all the things that did and didn't happen. Tom was a bit upset with coming second, you know, because second in a 4,000 player GP is, you know, a thing to be upset about.
Yeah, sure.
And AJ was, you know, trying to be nice to him and, you know, getting him drinks and stuff like that because he, like, felt bad for the guy who came second. You guys are fucking on drugs.
Speaking of drinks, congratulations, Anthony Hallett.
For drinking game. Tonight? Yeah, I am pretty shit, mate. Thanks for that, Isaac.
I was more talking about getting married, but, you know.
That's a thing that happened on the weekend as well. Like, Mr. Buster was there as well with fucking frog hat on. Here he is. Yeah. I actually got a picture of him right in front of me wearing a frog hat.
Oh, joy.
None of us can see that.
Excellent. I like that. Nobody needs to see it. No, it was a good. It was really good. It was a good wedding.
So this seems like a good opportunity as any. Nick Hastry. So long before you were at GP New Jersey, you were actually Australian national champion and international rookie of the year. Am I correct in saying that?
Once upon a time.
Tell me about nationals, firstly. What was it like leading up to that nationals and then obviously taking it out? Remembering what you can, given it was 6 years ago.
I played a lot of Magic leading up to that. I have a memorable round one because I didn't know how my combo won in my deck.
This is Aussie Storm, yeah?
Based upon...
I think so. No. Swan Song, right? Swans of Brian Argyle or something.
The Swans.
Yeah. Swan Aussie Assault.
Oh, that was right, you were playing that black and one redirect your ancestral visions. Is that was that one?
Yep.
Yeah, sweet.
Which I got off on Juzza in the top eight when he didn't know about the card. I also beat him by not playing a land, and then going off with a Lotus Petal with a Lotus coming
Lotus
in.
Bloom?
Sorry, would you mind explaining just what the deck does quickly?
All right, it plays a Swan, which is a 4-mana 4/3 creature. Swan says whenever it's dealt damage, draw that many cards. It plays a Seismic Assault.
The person who dealt that damage draws that many cards.
Yep, which is 3 red mana.
And prevents
land,
the damage.
Yep.
Deal 2 damage to target creature or player. And so it shoots the Swans, it gets a dredge return on a land, and it draws a card, and eventually it gets enough lands that it just like shoots its opponent out with all the lands that it's drawing. And deals him 20 off the dredge effects and the extra lands. Or it beats him down with 4/3 flyers, because that's a way that it can win as well. So round one of the tournament, I don't know how my combo works. And I've won game one, I think I've lost game two, and we're in game three, and I've got the game tied up. Like, I'm comboing off, and the guy's like, oh, combo off, because, you know, he wants to see me combo off, and, you know, he's clearly lost the round, but he doesn't want to concede the round without actually being comboed off. And I'm like, I don't know how this works. I don't know what it does with... Like, I didn't know the interactions with Darkmoor Salvage and how it would actually draw out the thing. So I work out based upon the lands in my deck and the cards in my hand. If I draw X cards based upon my deck size, my likelihood of drawing land, and then my likelihood of drawing the whole deck, and... then how many lands I'm going to need to deal exactly 20, and I work out mathematically that I'm like 99.9% to go off with this completely alternate way of winning the game, where I draw my whole deck and then shoot him for 20. Which is like...
not the way you're supposed to do
it. There's a whole bunch of people watching this match that know that I'm playing the deck and have been practicing with the deck, and they're like in pain. this is like the worst thing to watch ever, as I'm like doing the maths for 5 minutes, and then I'm like, alright, got it. And then like draw my whole deck and like shoot him out for 10, and then I'm like, that was the worst thing I've ever seen in Magic. I proceed to go XO with the deck. I go XO in the drafts, just drafting the best deck, because
I got Pelicans
for years, right? I just had this phenomenal record at Nats in Limited. Like, I think there's 3 years I went 6-0, three other years I went 5-1, or something like that. Like, I just ran the tables at Limited for some reason, and then on the Pro Tour, I did not run the tables at Limited. But anyway, that aside, that tournament went really well for me. I made some good plays in the top eight, and it just kind of worked out pretty good for me. I ended up winning the finals pretty easily. I decided not even to go for my combo. I ended up just beating him up with the birds. Then we went on from there. I had some pro points from that. I'd already been to a pro tour earlier in the year, and I top 32'd it with a green-black elves deck. And so I was in a spot to run for rookie of the year.
An Australian team like came second or something? Is that or
yep.
Is that right? Or
yeah, so I decided to quit my job and fly around playing a whole bunch of GPs. I played a bunch of them. I didn't go that well in that many of the GPs, despite having like a 7-2 in France and not making day two with no buys, because that was before the rules came in and it was a number cut.
That's gross.
And that was four pros on the way to a 7-2 from no buys. That was a pretty disappointing one not to make day two. But, yeah, we ran out the rest of the year. As we went into Worlds, I think I was slightly leading the race for Rookie of the Year, and I went 6-0 on day one, and I think Juzzle went 6-0 on day one, and I think the other guys went 5-1 or something, and, yeah, we ran pretty hot. I think that was Brendan Lau went 5-1. And then, yeah, across the event, we kind of kept it together, and we ended up running out into the top two teams, and I think we got pretty unlucky to lose to the Americans in the final of Worlds.
Amazing run. What were you doing in between GPs, like, if you had quit your job and you were just hanging out?
Well, I'd hooked up to stay with the guys, with Matt Nyong, who won nationals maybe three times in France, and Pedro Canales.
And got banned for a couple of years. He's back now, yeah? He can play again, yeah? Is that right?
I think so. I don't know.
I believe
so. They all seem to get banned, and then they come back, and then they go on, and you know, whatever. I don't know. But he was a really cool guy, really hospitable guy. From there, I kind of just hung out with Shuhei, who was with Wafa Tapa, and it was basically the team of Yasuka. Somebody help me.
Mm-hmm. Yasuka.
So there was a bunch of pros. We all just followed around the world together. I went and stayed at Shuhei's house for 3 weeks or 2 weeks or something like that. Ate a lot of Japanese food. They laughed at me for my inability at the time to use chopsticks, which drastically improved across that time. We just drafted 2-3 times every day. Was what basically happened in that space.
That sounds like an incredible year.
Yeah, and across this time, I met a lot of the guys. Like, I met Brad, I met AJ, I met all these guys that were coming onto the Pro Tour, as well as I was going to a lot of these events with LSV and Jerry and Portion and all those guys. So I got really close with basically a lot of the top pros, which a lot of those relationships have kind of stayed on, as you know the people, you know. They know you, you know them, and it's just it's really easy just to fall back into knowing them and just being part of that world. But yeah, that trip and that development of meeting all those people and becoming part of all those groups was really good and really good for my Magic game.
Yeah, I bet. How long were you away for in total?
I think I went for 4 months, and then I was Rookie of the Year after that. So then I had free flights to all the GPs. To all the pro tours the next year, and appearance fees, I think $2,000 US for each event and stuff. But yeah, I was at that point I fell into poker because there was just more money and it was easier. And the idea of, you know, $2,000 sounds like a lot, and a free flight sounds like a lot to show up at an event. But by the time you pay rent back home, you pay rent wherever you're staying in a hotel, and you pay for living costs, and you spend a month prepping for an event that you do or don't do very well in, it ends up not being that great of a deal as far as just like living. Like, you need to subsidize your living some other way with riding or with poker or with something else. Like, it was pretty tough, especially being from Australia, continuing being a pro. I think if I wanted to continue being a Magic pro, the best move would have been to move to America for me.
It certainly seems that way. Like, the chance of any non-American being Rookie of the Year now just seems next to impossible. How did you manage to tie it up so quickly?
to tie up Rookie, or you...
Yeah, you did it in 4 months is pretty remarkable.
Well, I already had a...
Plus the one Pro Tour, yeah.
As well as a Pro Tour, as well as if you get to play in teams, you've got a huge advantage points-wise.
Oh, huge.
So I ran pretty deep in the main event, and I got some concessions from some of the French guys that I was pretty good friends with. Yeah, Olivier Rouel sat down across from me and picked up his deck and walked off. You know?
That's gas. Do you still play poker now?
I play a little bit, but I'm kind of involved in running a couple of family businesses. The variance in poker is pretty high, and the lifestyle is certainly interesting.
I've heard it sucks real bad.
It has its good and its bad points. It's really hard when you maybe earn as much as somebody else earns in 4 or 5 hours, and then you don't want to do it because it's your job.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've made your money for the week, and then you want to party, but that works in a way that you end up spending more on your living because you're not at work for 30 or 40 hours of the week.
Yeah.
And as well as that, when things go bad, you run out of money real quick. Like, because you're dependent upon week to week to week, which you get in a regular job, whereas when you're playing poker, you need a bankroll and you need to be enjoying doing something that is work that you're not forced to do.
Yeah,
to be able to continue doing it. So, I don't know, it's an interesting one, and I got a lot of mixed feelings with it. Also, playing without a huge bankroll, which happens when you play Magic for a year and basically deplete all your funds and then choose to move across to poker without a whole lot of backing, is not the simplest thing to do.
Do you see you going back to it again one day?
No, I think there's a lot more money and a lot easier ways to make money than playing a negative sum game. You know, like, essentially, we pay for the big pretty buildings, for the casinos, for the staff, for all those things by sitting on those tables. And if you play 30, 40 hours a week, you'll pay more than most people's wages just across the table in your hourly rate.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so you have to be that much better than the game to break even. Than somebody's annual wage. You have to be better than the poker game by somebody's annual wage to break even.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really 1-2 players on the table win, everybody else loses. So it's a pretty negative sum game when 8 out of 10 people lose.
Certainly, yeah, it's an interesting perspective.
And, like, Magic's the same. It's a negative sum game. You know, we all pay $50 to enter. How much money do they collect?
Oh, yeah, it's disgusting.
How much do they pay out?
Yeah, don't get me started. It's revolting.
So there's not huge amounts of money to be made from any of these things if you can't move in other directions, either as a store, as a writer, as a content producer, or as something else to make it a viable path to go down.
Yeah, for jobs. So it's a hobby.
As a hobby, you can't compete with the guys that are doing it for a living.
Yeah.
So exactly. So that's the disadvantage that we have versus the American players that are at, you know, SGC events every week that are, you know, grind mode all day, that are live streaming for, you know, two premier events most days. And, you know, when you're in that world, you can be as good as those guys if you're dedicated enough. And, you know, like, I really believe it's mostly about time and the effort. More than any other factors.
You think that's true of most endeavors?
Yeah.
Yes and no, because obviously your starting positions and other things make a big difference. There's a lot of people that get to come into family businesses or get to come into spots or come into a business with a degree, and so they have a lot quicker progression. So it depends upon where you start at, but yeah, you can go get a degree. You can go spend the time to acquire the skills that you need to then put yourself in those spots.
Yeah, that's something that's really interesting, because I definitely thought that, like, a lot of Magic pros, yeah, just, like, you know, if they're good enough at Magic, they realize that there's more money in poker. But now that I hear that perspective, I realize that, yeah, like, just the fact that, you know, the casino takes so much money.
To be fair, yeah, if you went to a Magic tournament as, like, a top player, you expect to be in the top 20%.
Yeah.
It's the same deal.
You know? Yeah, that's true.
And it's... And it is doable. It's just, it's tough. You know, it's tough if you're not really enjoying it. If it stops being your passion, then you can't do it.
Yeah, fair.
So, you know, I would say for poker, that was a tough thing for me. For it to be my passion when it also had financial commitments, and it was just way less fun than Magic.
Isaac, recently we held in Melbourne a team championship, so I thought maybe you'd want to talk a little bit about that.
The Good Games Melbourne Australian National Teams Championships. Yes.
How did Sasha's team go, Isaac?
it was seriously like pretty much the most fun I've had playing an event in a very long time.
Oh, that's really great. Considering you guys did pretty average, it's really good to hear that you had a good time regardless.
Yeah, I mean, like, we were X1 going into the last round, so we didn't do that bad. The event was just, like, it was so much fun. Like,
everyone said it was so gas. Everyone just had such a good time that I've spoken to.
Yeah. Like every time we won or lost, like, you know, like, it was, you know, we had a lot of fun doing it. There was twice where, like, I turned to, because I was with Dan Unwin and Jeremy Neiman.
Nice team.
So
who you would think is the best team, right? And yet,
it
depends how much Magic they're actually playing.
Well, that's the thing. The three of us were actually.
It's a volume game, you know. Whoever's the most dedicated person at the time will be the best person in the room.
Yep, and that's always Juzza.
The grinder.
One, yeah. So, the three of us were like balls deep in uni for like the entire year. So we pretty much had a week, maybe a little bit over a week to prepare, like make the standard decks, find the standard decks, and learn the draft format. But, we did pretty good. Yeah, there was like twice where like I wasn't sure on the play, so I asked Dan, hey, Dan, what do you reckon the play is? And he's like, oh, you should do this. And I was like, cool, I'm going to do the other thing.
I think the worlds when we played together, we like didn't understand how to talk to each other.
Yeah.
We were like on the level where like John's is often just doing his own thing because he just like murder grinds forever. And so you're like, can I talk to this guy who's deeply involved in this like serious game for all the chips? And so we both just kind of like backed off like fish. And afterwards, Juzz was like, "I really wish you guys had talked to me." Because like, the Americans had a whole like team thing going on. I don't know, you know. I'm not going to say too much about that, but, you know, it was a little bit, yeah.
Isaac, are you going to do it again next year?
Oh, 100%, it's locked in. Actually, what I'm going to do is, I haven't sourced it yet, but we're actually going to get, like, a perpetual trophy. So, one of the sweet things was that everybody got their individual trophy, which was, like, a little plaque thing that was, I don't know, pretty cool. And we're going to get, like, a big cup, I think. And every year, yeah, we're going to...
This is better than I got for Rookie of the Year. I got... I did get free flights and some money and stuff, but I got no trophy. And the year before, there was pro player cards. The year before, the person was printed in every pack of Magic cards. Which was Watanabe. I feel like I got screwed.
Didn't even get a trophy.
Play a championship and stuff. I'm like, this is balls.
Yeah, well, you have to come down next year because we'll definitely have it every year.
And
we might put a couple of extra words.
What's the format?
So it's Team Unified Standard.
Oh God.
And Team Unified Draft.
Team Sealed. Yeah.
Team Sealed. So yeah, 12 packs of whatever the limited format is, and you have to build 3 decks out of that.
And
you can figure that out on the spot. I don't even think you need to do any practice for that one.
Well,
it's a gold set, so it's a little bit tricky.
It was actually really difficult. Funny. We
that's what I love. Like, I'm from all the gold sets. All I do is play Cube on Moto. Like, give me gold sets.
Yeah, it is reminiscent of Cube. Actually, it's interesting you bring that up.
Yeah. So
that's what I'm basically
awesome
advocating.
Thing.
Just play Cube and you'll be good at Magic.
If you did Unified Standard Legacy and Modern, that'd be sweet.
Well, yeah, that's the other option, to have, like, one player playing, like, Highlander, one person playing Modern.
Oh, yeah, Highlander, yes.
Oh, that'd be
so
weird.
Highlander Legacy and Modern.
Like,
Highlander Legacy and
okay,
Modern.
I really like the idea of Highlander, but I don't like the idea that the world's not embracing it and not getting on board. If we're playing formats that the rest of the world's not interested in, how do we develop? How do we get on the same level? How do we go over to Legacy events and compete if we've got our guys playing Highlander events?
That was one of the big things that the reason why we did Team Unified Standard was to help the actual Australian team prepare for the World Magic Cup.
Oh, nice.
So to create...
Which I really like. I think we have to build the players into trying to go overseas, into trying to basically do what I did. If they're in a fortunate enough situation to go take the trips and put it all on the line.
Yeah, so that was definitely one of the big things. Before I even announced it, I actually contacted Jazza and said, you know, I've got this idea, what do you think about it? And Jazza said, yeah, look, that'd be awesome. Apparently I told him that I'd give the Australian team free entry. I forgot about that and then charged them entry.
Yeah.
He showed me the message later and I was like, ah, cool, I'll give you
some. To be fair, that was across three different teams, though.
They're split across two different teams.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Well, yeah. They don't get entry. They have to play as a team.
No, in the end I gave one of those teams free entry, which was the non-Jazza team. So,
it is Jazza.
And Jazza ended up coming first, so they got like $900 or whatever, so I'm pretty sure they were fine with paying the entry.
Okay,
second was Nathan Damatoro Abdus. No one can pronounce his surname.
All right.
And
have to play together, by the way.
Yeah, Justin Nagel and
if you're trying to
Alex Victory.
For this reason, right, the idea is for that team to sync. Those guys to know each other, know how to chat, to, you know, go over to the next event without not having played with each other before.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah. I think it's really good to have the national team there.
Well, I mean, the problem with having the national team is that there's actually four people in the national team. And this team event was teams of three, because otherwise you have a fourth person just kind of not playing any magic.
The fourth person, you know, watch the three.
Is the fourth person a reserve? Like, how?
Yeah, but the problem is that then you've got far less teams overall, because you've got teams of four people instead of teams of three. So
I think it's just play first, second, and third. Play as the team. The fourth person's on their own as the sub. They used to be the...
I think they wanted everybody to get some experience in playing in a team. So they wanted... So they ended up splitting the team up into two and a ringer and two and a ringer.
Okay.
That way they could actually...
Yeah,
like, and they all talk to each other. They all still talk to each other and, you know, like... Or, you know, the two teams of three, I guess, came up with deck lists and deck ideas and, you know, it helped, yeah, inspired them to get ringers to help them as well.
I do like the way that you did the format. Like, it does create a need to make new developments within that format, not just to play the best deck.
Yeah, I think it's also going to be kind of interesting, like, watching the World Magic Cup. I think that everybody that played the event now actually has a kind of insight into the event that most viewers won't know, because they'll sit down and go, oh, I wonder what their team is playing, because this is what we came up with. I wonder if they came up with a similar idea. Or
at least,
you know,
like that tournament to get together ideas and then to keep moving forward with those ideas.
Yeah. And I think next year's going to be bigger, because I think that a lot of people had fun with it. The only problem is next year we don't get to couple it with a PDQ. This year it was benefit that we had the Saturday was the PDQ, Sunday was the team's champs.
But you didn't have
so you could convince people
to
travel.
You didn't have a lot of interstaters, though, to be fair.
We definitely had some people from Canberra and some, you know, two teams from Sydney/Brisbane. Well, they're the
how many players did you get?
We had 100, so 99 players, 33
wow.
teams. So it's one of the biggest non-PDQ events in Australia.
It was really, really good. You did a really
good
job.
Did you queue the day before?
For the PDQ, we had
160, yeah.
Yeah, 163. So,
what do you think you'd have to offer? Do you think that format was not as accessible? Why do you think you got...
A couple of things. One, is just a little bit more difficult to find a team.
Yep.
And two, it's constructed versus limited. I think that limited is usually... the most popular, as well as Khan's Limited being the most popular, and that was the PDQ was Khan's Limited.
Okay.
So there's definitely, I think there's also an element of it just being the first one, so, you know, like everybody knows about PDQs, so they, you know, were keen to get on board. I think next year, you know, anybody that just managed to convince two people to go with them is going to be thinking about it months beforehand and going, all right, I'm going to have these two people, and, you know, make them commit to that weekend. I know that, like, yeah, like, I actually want to run another team event, like, really soon, because I just want to play in another one.
Sure. And maybe this is the format that takes over. The Australian Magic is team formats.
I've been trying to pester Rob Tierney to allow Australia to have a team GP. He said on his Facebook, yeah. He said, get 1,000 players and we'll talk.
Please quote what Rich Hagen said. That was my favourite moment in Wizards of Oz history.
What did he say?
When he said, Australia can't have a team GP because people like Riley Knight can't get friends to play with them.
Rich Hagen, troll. Who would have known he was such a successful troll?
He was so good. He was one of my all-time favourite pro guests. He was just awesome.
So the PTQ on Saturday, that was, of course, won by a friend of the show, Wilfie Horrig. We're all very happy with him, right, Isaac?
Is it Wilfie Horrig or Horrig?
Or Gas, etc.?
I beg your pardon? Horse the Gas, yeah.
The second one, definitely the second one.
Yeah, I think it's pronounced Horrig.
I have to check with him.
We'll have to check.
He'll never hear, I can assure you. He'll never hear the statement. But obviously, everyone very happy to hear.
Nobody else is stupid enough to get an hour and 34 minutes into this shit.
Yeah.
Hey, that's actually something that came up because, I don't know, I want to hear what you guys think about this. Because, all right, so there's Team Sneak and Show, right? Bunch of people on it. You get to the finals of this PDQ, and both players are actually in Team Sneak and Show. So that's a testament to actually, you know, how much, you know, being in that team environment, them actually helping each other and, like, you know, learning from each other and people talking about formats has actually really helped them. Like, I think everybody in Team Sneak and Show has actually produced better results as a result of
I feel like it's a combination of all the best guys in Australia. I think relevant of whether they are in a team,
grab all the
not
best
they're
players.
Gonna do well.
Yeah.
I think yes, yeah, but it's also inspired them to actually collaborate.
But Wolfie's been a top player for ages.
Who was the other
Dylan,
player?
You know, when I think of a bunch of the players
yeah.
in the team.
Sorry, I missed who player. The other player was.
Tim Hughes.
I mean, they were top eighting before Sneak and Show. Sneak and Show just grabbed all the players that could make top eight. So, like,
No. I'm talking about more like there's some more like. I think they are doing just a little bit more consistently well.
It doesn't mean they haven't been getting better since they joined the team, which they definitely...
Yeah, yeah. I think that they've definitely shown a more consistent result. Yes, they still have, you know,
the
best
guys,
players in the team.
I think the guys need to be able to be testing together.
They are testing together.
Every Wednesday.
Yeah, like the Melbourne players are testing together. And both of these guys...
But, like, every Wednesday versus, you know, Brad and Todd testing 5 days a week.
Yeah, of course.
Like,
yeah,
okay,
baby
know,
steps.
We're not on the
baby
level.
Steps.
You know, like, if those guys came over here, they'd just crush us.
Sure, but we only have to be better than everyone else here.
Yeah. Yes, you go over and you play in...
Fuck that!
Hey, Sammy, have you got another episode out of your other podcast?
No, because Paddy is in Thailand right now. When he's back, we're going to be recording again. I stupidly made a post on the Facebook page saying that we'd be doing it this week, and then was told straight away that no, we wouldn't be doing it this week. But we will be back really soon. Really looking forward to it, actually, because with Wilfie, Paddy Robertson and I do another show together, and obviously with Wilfie winning the PTQ, we've got a lot to talk about.
Wolf's a Gas, etc.
Wolf's a Gas, etc. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed having both of you on. I certainly
Norris.
Hope you'll both come back again soon.
No problem.
Sure.
Isaac and Wrangler, thank you very much as always.
You're welcome.
I'm a lot soberer now than when this started. Like, I feel like now would be a good time to begin this show.
we're just going to jump off, and then you can just start the show. Sound good?
Sure, got this. Easy.
So thank you very much for joining us, everybody. This has been December 2014 of The Wizards of Oz, and we'll see you next time.
Ciao.
Don't drink and podcast.
The entire weekend was great.
So, Buster, I heard AJ had some things to say about Dylan.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what he was saying, except that he was crazy or something like that.
Partially McCastry, because... do you know some of this story, since Dylan's not here?
Oh, yeah, I know plenty of this story.
I know the story.
So,
go on. Tell us a story. Tell us an Isaac story.
Tell us a story.
Okay.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time. Okay. So the story is, once upon a time, yeah, Dylan and his now ex-girlfriend at the time, were, I think, hooked up at the time. They'd booked flights to go to New Jersey because, well, she was going to meet up in Las Vegas with him after New Jersey. They then broke up, which left an awkward situation because he'd already paid for the flights and she, I think, had paid for the accommodation. So he had to book new accommodation. About 2 weeks before the event, he then met this other girl, hit it up pretty well, and he brought her home, and the first thing his mum said to him was, "Do you have a passport?" His mum pretty much offered to pay for her flight to Vegas with Dylan.
So this is based upon the mum not liking the ex-girlfriend wanting this girl to go with him so that he's not hanging around his ex because, you know, he's with a girl in Vegas and, you know, what's going to happen with a girl in Vegas if you're sharing the same room?
Yeah.
So there was, like, alter ego and alter motive, I guess, going on there. And AJ, upon hearing this story, just, like, lost his shit.
Yeah.
It was just
pretty
like,
funny.
You are fucking insane. It was just like, I'm blown away for 12 different reasons. And Dylan's, like, fanboying him because, you know, he's the guy that taught everybody how to play Brainstorm. And he's just, like, completely mind-blown and just putting, like, shit on Dylan for, like, half an hour, and Dylan's just loving it.
It was pretty funny.
So I also read a line, Dylan's new girlfriend is, like, 18 or 19, so she can't drink or gamble in Vegas at all.
Yep.
So, yeah, like,
can't legally drink.
The other part of the story, because AJ's like, what the fuck are you going to do in Vegas? And he's like, you know what I'm going to do. And, like, his girlfriend, so he booked another room, and they're, like, three rooms away in the same, in the MGM from each other, from, like, where he stayed with his new girlfriend to where his old girlfriend is. He's on the same flight back from Vegas with his ex, his
and
old
his
girlfriend, and he's...
That's insane!
And so, like, it's just messed up in so many different ways, and it's just, like...
Yeah,
he caught a little bit of shit.
They also met. They met each other while they were there as well. I don't know exactly everything that happened with it.
Yeah, I met the other night that they ran into.
He's known for 2 weeks, right?
Yeah.
Oh, he's known the chick for 2 weeks. She goes on a flight to Vegas with him.
And his mom's like, gone when she's walked into the house.
Do you have a passport?
Record? Do you have a passport?
Oh, shout out to Dylan's mom. She's really hot. Dylan tried to get me in trouble the other night. He was like, "Oh, Maya Rangel said he'd root my mum," and Maya goes, "Whatever." And then later on, I go, "Did you hear what she said?" She goes, "I didn't listen to that kid."